Thank you for downloading this podcast from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. This episode of Pardes Live and Miniseries is a personal conversation between Yiscah Smith and Rabbi Ari Ze'ev Schwartz. We'd like to thank Rabbi Schwartz and the Society of Independent Spirituality for making this podcast. If you are interested in more digital downloads or other Jewish content, please visit elmod.pardes.org.
So Yiscah, I'm sitting in your home and I can see so many books. And you told me these aren't even the important books. The important books are in your bedroom. So I want to ask you, would you be able to recommend three really transformative books for your, you know, people who follow you and listen to you and really take your word seriously, that you would recommend? You know, these are three books you should immerse yourself in, and if you give yourself to these books, they would really transform you.
Okay. I didn't have time to, you know, this is a regular chat. You caught me here. Yes, I do love my sfarim. I love them. I live with them. That's why I extended my bedroom into my study. I'd say the three, though, to answer your question directly, you're asking me to pick three. The first would be The Sabbath by Heschel. That book more than helped me decide to become Shomeret Shabbat. It gave me an inkling. It gave me a window, a lens to see Judaism in a way that I've never experienced in any other. It was remarkable, the sacredness of time rather than place in so much of Western spiritual disciplines. Western religions sanctify space, where we do sanctify space. Hamakom, the Har Habayit, that's the only place. But the book, The Sabbath by Heschel, to answer the question. The second book would be B'nai Machshava Tova by the Pious Etzner. It's been loosely translated as Conscious Community by one of the translators. It's also spiritual practice, both as an individual and in community. And the third would be, which I think I'll spend the rest of my life reading. The third is The Quest for Authenticity, which is the thought of Reb Simcha Bonum. It's a compilation written by Michael Rosen, Zichrono Levracha. May his memory be for a blessing. And this book is devoted to understanding that what made Reb Simcha Bonum Reb Simcha Bonum was his quest for authenticity. Mamash, it's like his thoughts of, like, just to quote one piece, just one short piece, where he says the greatness of a tzaddik, the greatness of a Rebbe, is not so the Hasid can become lost in the charisma of the Rebbe, where the Hasid becomes lost, so to speak, but rather the tzaddik can help the Hasid find himself or herself. That's the greatest thing, a tzaddik, a righteous person, a leader, a teacher, a Rebbe. That's the greatest gift you can give someone, is a piece of themselves, that without which they wouldn't know. So this is a book I started a couple of years ago. I may have assumed I'll probably keep reading it and reading it and reading it. Those are my three books: The Sabbath, B'nai Machshava Tova, and The Quest for Authenticity.
So Yiscah, I want to talk to you about, we were talking before about the importance of authenticity for you and being true to yourself and to the Tzelem Elokim. So now I want to talk to you like from the different point of view. You talk a lot in your writings and in your speeches and talks about the importance of having a spiritual community, which is kind of the other side of the coin. You know, in a lot of like religions around the world, definitely like New Age spirituality, there's a strong focus on seclusion and being yourself and being away from the conformities of the world around you. And definitely in Buddhism, there's a strong focus on like enlightenment coming through you being on your own, meditation. But in your writings, and I know you're very attracted to the Pious Etzner Rebbe, you really stress, you give this big emphasis on spiritual community. And I've heard also you have this great relationship with so many of your students that you actively invite them into your life and you want them to feel like there's this kihila, this spiritual community. So I want to ask you, why is spiritual community so important to you? And also, how is that related to the Pir Zetzner Rebbe? Did you get it from his writings? Did you realize that after, before?
Yes, spiritual community is very, very, very important. Because Hashem created us, and this is from the Pir Zetzner, the book B'nei Machshava Tova, which is how to bring spiritual and elevated consciousness into community, is very much determined by sensing the divine presence within and then being able to see that in others. So it's not an either or. It's really gam v'gam. To the degree that when I seclude, to quote you back, the word seclusion, I do seclude myself periodically, like on a daily basis, when I go into my own private meditative contemplative silence. The goal, though, of what makes Jewish, for me, as I've learned from the Pir Zetzner, what makes Jewish meditation Jewish, is that I then can encounter a deeper part of myself that I share with you. So instead of trying to force myself, as many of us do, to see it in you, I practice daily encountering through opening my heart up to all the different feelings that would determine. He even says each feeling is a maftayach to the neshama. So the degree to then which I'm actually accessing and having an awareness of my own piece of God, the chalek, like Eov said, the chalek of God from above, and the Bala Tanya adds in Tanya, mamash, that my essence really is a piece of God. That very breath that God breathed into Adam and Chava was a piece of God's essence. The degree to which I can allow me and discipline me private time to sense that profoundly affects the rest of my day when I go out into the world. And actually, the Pir Zetzner quoted the Bala Tanya a lot in his different Sfarim. And he was very mushpa, he was very influenced by the Bala Tanya. And the Bala Tanya writes, the Rebbe HaZakein, the Alter Rebbe, Rebbe Shneur Zalman of La'adi, writes in Tanya in Perek Lamed Bet, which is Lev, the very heart of Tanya, that the way to fulfill the mitzvah, v'ahavta l'reyacha kamocha, love your fellow as yourself, which all too often we equate that with, somehow I have to love everybody, I have to force myself to really appreciate and like everybody. That's not Ahavat Yisrael. Ahavat Yisrael, I'm giving the Bekitzor, or Regalaha, the short version, is when I identify me with the peace that through all my ups and downs in life, I love myself for it. It's not temporary, it's not Shatului B'davar. So whether I'm a good or not good lecturer, or whether I'm a not good or good cook, or whatever it is, there's something in my essence that warrants my identifying me with so much, so I'll always love myself for it. And that's my soul. That's my Tzelem Elokim that I was created in. That, to the degree that I discipline and practice that as my, when I look into my spiritual mirror, that's what I see in you. And that's what I love about you. I may not like you. Liking has to do more with midot, with behavior, you're this, you're that, but I love you. Meaning there's a hit kashrut. We're going back to the Pir Zetzner. He talks about this frequently. Hit kirvut and hit kashrut. Closeness and connection. That's Jewish practice.
So I'm sitting here with Yiska in her beautiful home in Nachlaot. And I want to ask you, Yiska, you really are kind of the center piece of this whole beautiful community in Nachlaot, but also in Jerusalem, of of LGBTQ, and there's just so many people who are trying to find themselves. They want Orthodox Torah, but they also want to be accepted for who they are. And from the majority of people, they just, you know, they can't go together, and they can't accept these two very complex parts inside of themselves, you know, ne'emanut, loyalty to Torah and tradition, and but also ne'emanut, loyalty to themselves and the way they feel Hashem made them. So I want to ask you, how do you make space for people who are different to you, but at the same time be loyal to these, you know, these ancient Jewish values? How do you create that space? Because the majority of people feel like they can't make that space. So I feel like you have some, you know, incredible experience in this field, because you make space for so many different types of people. Haredi, religious Zionist, one Orthodox, Reform, conservative, Orthodox, gay, you know, straight. It's just obviously transgender. There's just so much that you have made space for in your life. So I really want to ask you, what do you feel is an insight that would help people make space for the other?
I so appreciate that question. I really, really value and honor that question. I believe that's one of the questions that needs to be addressed today, starting with the leadership of all the different expressions of Jewish leadership in our world of Am Yisrael. How I answer it, first of all, my own journey. I do believe, having been born with gender identity dysphoria, and finally, I'm what's called a late bloomer, addressing it responsibly and asking Hashem to guide me, my own transition was probably, no, not probably, my own transition was more of a spiritual tikkun than one of a gender transition, because that's when I first began to really sense Hashem's presence. It's like I went through this murky depths of deception and lies, not intending to be unfaithful to my own inner self. I just didn't know any other way to be. Remember, I was born in the 1950s, not 1995 or 2000. So it was a different world then. But what my journey has allowed me to do, and this is why I so honor my journey and see it as a part of a divine plan, it's allowed me to see all different kinds of people, and I see their struggles in their journey to be true to themselves without me having to. It's not a matter of me agreeing or understanding or being sensitive. It's not about me at all. It's about me giving them space and honoring their own journey. And the way I can do that is when I see another person, I don't see what makes them different than me. I see what makes them similar to me. They're created equally in the image of God. I believe we need to get back to this. This was a consciousness brought to us by our Avot and Imahot. This is not like 50 years ago or 500 years ago. Our whole Yesod is based on sensing Hashem's presence in each one of us. And two teachings in particular have profoundly, profoundly influenced me in this. Each one is very short, but very profound. The first is from Reb Shlomo Kalbach. He said, every time you see someone that's different than you externally, that's Hashem's way of saying your next growth, your next tikkun, what's being asked of you is to find a piece of you in that person and try to hold a piece of that person inside of you. None of us will duplicate each other. Not all of you in me and all of me in you. There's only all of me and all of me. But to the degree that I allow the discomfort to be able to motivate me, because I believe it's divine providence that I'm encountering you, so therefore, if it's divine providence, Hashem is giving me the inner resources. So it's only my ego, which could be fear-based or survival-based, that would prevent that from happening. So that's one teaching, is to see a piece of me, a little piece of me inside of you, and allow a piece of you inside of me. The second teaching is from Rabbi Landis, and he was quoted at not the most recent, but the one before, when he gave smicha to 21 musmachim and musmachot in Yedidya that evening. And he was quoted to have said by a student of his who he gave smicha to years before, who flew in to Yerushalayim to give the key address, that Rav Landis told him that I bless you as you go out into being a leader, that may anybody in front of you, everyone in front of you, always be more important than your ideas within you. It doesn't mean you compromise your ideas, but if you're going to struggle, struggle with your ideas. Go to your mashpia, go to your rav, go to your rabbah, go to your husband, your wife, your chavruta, but don't ever struggle with the person. Don't ever struggle with the other person, because again, that's divine providence. You're supposed to be panim lefanim, face to face with that person, whatever it means. So what causes discomfort, welcome to growth.
So Yiska, you know, you have gone through so many different obstacles in your life and really overcame them in the most magnificent way. So I want to ask you, you know, if someone's listening and they're struggling with something, could be struggling with like a real terrible sickness, and they're losing hope, or it could be a person who's struggling in a broken relationship, or it could be a person who's struggling with gender issues, sexual issues, identity issues, and or it could be a person who's struggling, you know, suicidal, that something, you know, really is blocking them from meaning and happiness and, you know, the will to go on. What advice would you give to them? If you could, you know, just for a few minutes talk about, you know, what would you want someone to hear in that moment of darkness?
I really hesitate to answer this question because I don't like to give advice. I rather share experiences. But you asked me the question. So I feel in honoring you, I want to offer advice that is as klali and is, but yet is not absolute. And I hope whoever listens to this hears it with the compassion that I'm sharing it with, that it's enveloped, it's muluvash, muluveshet, the etza is muluveshet, is enclosed with compassion. I turned to Viktor Frankl in Man's Search for Meaning when he started realizing trends at Auschwitz. I mean, he lived at the same time as the Piasetzna, but from such a different world, from Vienna as a psychiatrist who was not the most observant of Jewish either spirituality or halachic practice. And yet, he believed that the ikar, the essential ingredient that a human being needs is not to be happy, but to have meaning in life. And when he was in Auschwitz, it was a real challenge for him. And what he did to give his own life meaning, he started studying trends. And he noticed that there were people who may have been younger than others, may have been stronger physically, believe in God, not believe in God. But he was able to see when they gave up to despair. And within 72 hours, they passed. And then he saw people who may have been more frail, older, again, believing in God, not believing in God, who held on. So it perplexed him, which actually kept him alive. What was the difference between the two? If it was not physical strength, and it was not even spiritual strength, he came up with this conclusion. And this is my advice, that first of all, pause. Don't do anything if a person's in that kind of darkness. Pause and try to create the shift of the question that you're asking. What did he notice? The question that people came into Auschwitz with was, what does life have to offer me? We all ask that question. Life has to offer me health, companionship, love, family, community, all these beautiful ideals. What do you say that when you're in Auschwitz? Lo aleinu, we don't even know what, we can't even imagine how horrible it was. The people who kept asking that question got to a point where, how did they answer? What does life have to offer me? Nothing. And when he said within 72 hours they were gone. The other people, including himself, was they realize, I need to shift. I need to ask a different question. Rather, instead of what does life have to offer me, what is life asking of me? What is life asking of me? So for all of those, and really it's all of us have moments. My moments are not finished. That one moment is finished. There'll be another moment. When there's darkness, when it's not really clear, when there's suffering, as the Piacessna writes, suffering can bring one close to God where joy cannot. Just the way joy can bring one close to God where suffering cannot. But ultimately, the question I need to ask when I'm suffering is, what's being asked of me? What's being asked of me? That's worth my attention. That's worth captivating my soul in that moment. And there I may have an answer.
So, Yisko, a few weeks ago, I shared with you this idea of Rav Shigar about Tshuva of Ulai, the idea that we can't know for certain if everything will work out. But emunah in Hashem, faith in Hashem, is the willingness to be open to the ulai, to the maybe, that perhaps everything could change and perhaps it couldn't, but to be open to that, perhaps that's the deep experience. And I remember you contacting me and we discussed it, and I saw this excitement in you. So I want to ask you, why did that idea speak to you so strongly? Why did the idea of opening yourself up to the tshuva of ulai, of the maybe, the divine maybe, why is that so important to you?
It is indeed important, and I want to thank you for sharing that and for publishing it. I have since published it and shared it with many, many people, and I can see the response is just absolutely, it's magnificent. So for me in particular, I've noticed over the years, over the past 45, 50 years, going into Elul, the month before Rosh Hashanah, people walk around almost bragging. I don't think they mean to, but it's almost bragging how heavy it is. Like, oh, we have to really start doing teshuvah. And of course, the heavier it is, the more likely it's not going to happen. So it's as if the Rambam's Hilchot Teshuvah, it's like Lahavdil, to make a distinction, it's like the side panel of a cake mix. And every time you try to make it happen, the cake doesn't come out right. So what happens? We feel, well, there's something wrong with me. So not only do I go into Rosh Hashanah feeling heavy, but I feel like a failure. I feel like, what am I doing wrong? What am I not doing right? And we take on a lot of this heaviness where my understanding, according to Chassidut, surely according to Chabad Chassidut, Alachat Chama V'Kama, to the Piyasetzna and Rav Kook, of feeling close. It's like the Ben Melech, as opposed to an Eved who's out there in some hamlet grinding away at the millstone, who's obedient but doesn't feel close to the king. But we, Hashem created us to be Banim Hashem L'Elokeichem. You're not only subjects of the king, but you're also children of the king. What's the difference? The child is in the palace with the king, sits on the king's lap. Here is benefits from being close to the king. So where was I going with this? I totally forgot. What?
Ulai.
Ulai. The ulai, what that gave to me is an opening. Because what you were teaching me from Rav Shigar is ulai opens to the potential of the infinite. If what I'm returning to is really God, well, God is infinite. So therefore, how can I be sure if I'm returning to the infinite? By definition, it just resonates so much. It freed me from having to return to someone else's understanding of what I'm supposed to return to, which never works, which is why there's this heaviness. It's from a place of failure rather than, oh, wow, yeah, God is infinite. It's not a matter of me mastering it. It's not a matter of me capturing it. Like it says in the Zohar, Ein Tefisa Beklal, you really can never really grasp it, but you can feel closeness. And what you're feeling closeness is to the possibility. maybe, just maybe, today I'll feel a little bit closer. That's teshuvah. Gewalt.
So, Yisku, we were just talking about Rav Kook and how powerful his writings are. In his writings, he has this distinction between like the Torah of Galut and the Torah of Eretz Yisrael of Geula. And I've heard you mention it to me in previous conversations, and I've also seen you here and there hint to it in your writing. So I want to ask you, what does it mean there that there is a Torah of Galut? And what does it mean that there's a Torah of Geula, of Eretz Yisrael, for you, in your opinion?
So for me, in my experience, and I want to emphasize this is my experience, this is not Torah Misinai, this is a Torah Mimani. The Torah Galut, how I've come to see it in my life, and by the way, the text can be the same. It's the consciousness. It's not that there's a body of literature that's Torah Galut, and then there's a different body of literature. It's me as the learner. How am I interacting? How am I engaging with the text? So Galut, which we've spent as a nation more, the greater period of ours, if you want to start with the giving of the Torah 3,400 years ago, or from the times of our Avot and Imahot, we'll go close to 3,800 years ago, 39. We spent most of it in Galut. We spent most of it in Galut. Galut, how I've experienced it spiritually, how I see it. It could be in Yerushalayim, it could be in Tokyo. Is survival. Many people throughout the years have said, you know, we're a very special people because we've survived over all these years. And I'm thinking, I don't want to survive. If I have to survive, if life creates a certain situation where lack of food, God forbid, lack of shelter, there's oppression, well then yes, I have to survive. But I don't believe God created me to survive as the ultimate. And again, I really want to emphasize this is my experience, because my coming into Judaism in the 1970s was to survive. It was a survival technique, and that's how I related to it, which is why I believe I really did not sense Hashem's presence for all those years. And the word gola, which is another word for galut, which is being in exile, is the same letters as geula. Only the word geula has aleph in it, which is the presence of God, of the echad. So what is geula? It's taking everything that, for example, in my personal history, because my grandparents were born in America, my great-grandparents, their parents, all their prayers, that, and I envision, I sense that they prayed that someday down the line, there'd be someone in their family living in Yerushalayim. I mean, in Poland, in the Ukraine, in Russia, we're talking like in the mid-1800s. That was like such a dream. With tears, I visualize them crying to God from the place of survival, that there'd be somewhere down the line where they'd have a grandson, a grandchild, great, where that child did not have to survive but could thrive. And that's the Torah of Geula. It's where I'm able to see in my life beyond survival, beyond a space of scarcity, beyond a place like Reb Shlomo teaches, there's going to be a time, Habayim, Hayamim Baim, you know, the prophet Amos said this, that there's going to be a Ra'avon, there's going to be a Tzama'on, there'll be a hunger, there'll be a thirst, it will not be for bread, it will not be for water, it will be to really hear and to taste the very living, the words of the living God. And he says that's when we're going beyond survival. That's when we want to go into our own Kodesh HaKadoshim and really celebrate and thrive and produce more Torah of redemption, not of galut.
So I'm sitting here with Yisca Smith, and I want to ask you a few questions. We're sitting in your holy home in Nachlaot. And I thought the first question we could start with is, I see in your writings over and over again, you use this word authenticity a lot. It's everywhere. I'm sure you're aware of it. because you're a great writer, so you pick your words. So I want to ask you, because, you know, usually organized religion kind of stays away from these words, and they're more focused on words like, you know, obedience to God and, you know, doing what the community does. But in all of your talks and writings, this word self-expression and authenticity comes up and up again. So I want to ask you why you're attracted to this word authenticity. What does it mean to you? And then number two, did you find that concept in certain Jewish thinkers, and then you translated it into this word authenticity? And who are those Jewish thinkers for you?
You've touched on a very important dilemma that a lot of people find themselves in. I found myself in that dilemma. On one hand, I very much for many years wanted to be part of a community. We're social beings. That's how God created us. On the other hand, when I realized that to be with my community, to be accepted by my community, by the social norms and expectations, I wasn't being true to myself. I felt like I was trading pieces of my own soul in. I was trading them in to the greater klal of the community. And I remember every Friday night when we daven the Amidah for Shabbat, and for the Amidah for Shabbat, Shacharit and Mincha, we say, V'tahel lebeinu la'avdecha be'emet. I would cringe when I would say that. Because if there really is a HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and I'm asking HaKadosh Baruch Hu to purify a part of me in my heart, so I can be with God and serve God and be in the relationship be'emet, in truth, but I'm saying it not from a place of truth. So if there is God, well then who am I kidding? And if there isn't God, why am I saying it? So it brought me to a real crisis, a theological crisis. And then I discovered, thank God, I discovered I didn't know what authenticity meant in the Jewish world. I just knew when I said V'taha libeinu l'abdecha be'emet, I wasn't be'emet. That was what I had clarity on, and I didn't feel right about that. And then I came upon this incredible teaching from Rav Kook in his Perush on the Hakdamah to the Haggadah Shel Pesach. And he talks about what it means to be a free person, a ben chorin. And when I learned how he understood a ben chorin, I said, ah, that's it. That's it. What is a ben chorin? He said you could be enslaved physically, but with the spirit, with the ruach of a ben chorin, the spirit of a free person. And that's when you are, and the key, the active word was ne'aman, when you're faithful, when you're ne'aman, which is the Selam Elokim Shenev Rabo. When you're faithful to the soul inside of you, the very essence of the image of God that you were created in, then you're free. And I realized that's what it means for me to be authentic.
There are so many amazing characters and rabbis and prophets and deep thinkers throughout Jewish history that you have read about, that you've studied, Yiska, and, you know, throughout your life. I want to ask you, if you could go back in time and meet one great Jewish thinker, prophet, rabbi that you would love to meet, who would it be, and what would you want to ask them?
Oh, gosh, that's hard. That's a hard question. I mean, three pop up. Three. All right, so I'll let the listener decide of the three. Yaakov Avinu, the Pious Etzna, and Nechama Leibowitz. Yaakov, because Yaakov becoming Yisrael was my, that's my story. That's my whole story when he was finally able to see the face of God, Pnei El, when he struggled that night, that famous night. That was my whole journey, was I was able to, so many years, all those years, I wanted to sense God's presence and not necessarily have to be religious. And there I was being very religious, but I never sensed Hashem's presence. And just like Yaakov with the hand, that was my given Hebrew name was Yaakov. So there's a resonance there. I was always running away from or running towards. I was never with me. And that, when I started to really struggle with my own angels, my own demons, I began to sense Hashem's presence. So yes, Yaakov for sure, Yaakov Avinu. The PSSA, because he has shown me how to cultivate. He's shown me how to cultivate practice, to take that awareness, and it doesn't have to be once in a lifetime. It doesn't have to be one night in my life, one moment. It could be a daily practice, which so profoundly affects how I go out into the world and see Hashem's presence in other people, in all forms of creation, living creations, the plants, the trees, the minerals, water, the soil, my garden. So surely the P.S.S.N.A. And the Chama Leibowitz, because she pushed the envelope as a woman. She really did. L'shem Shemayim. L'shem Shemayim, as I continued to be pushing the envelope as a transitioned woman, I have a voice that I believe Hashem wants Am Yisrael to hear. I look at her. I look at her. It's not so much her commentaries, which I absolutely like, am dwarfed by. I mean, it's like, oh my gosh. Is that she had the sacred, like Rabbi Nachman says, she had the Azut Kedusha. She had the sacred chutzpah to push ahead and push ahead and push ahead because she had to. She had to. It was her calling. And she has so inspired me as a woman to do that, to push ahead. I have had to face language of hatred, of bitterness, of narrow-mindedness, of fear, of all types. And all I can do is keep pushing ahead with compassion, keep pushing ahead. I think of her. She was not Rabbah, she was not Rabbanit, she was not Rav, she was Nechama. And her name is a name of comfort. She gives me a lot of comfort in ways beyond, way beyond her commentaries and her commentaries.
So Yiska, you know, you've been teaching Jewish spirituality, Torah, Hasidut, for really, you know, so many years of your life. And what I've read, at least, is early on in your life, you were living in the old city, and you were very passionate and involved in the world of Chabad and Chabad teachings and its beliefs and its texts. And then later on in your life, you've been focusing more on the Pir Zetzner Rebbe. So I want to ask you, what do you feel each one Chabad Torah has contributed to you, and what has Pir Zetzner Rebbe contributed to you? And maybe just elaborate a little bit on your relationship between those different worlds that you have delved into.
Oh, Rav Ari, no one's ever asked me that question. So thank you. I first, what drew me into Chabad in the 1970s was the passion to talk about God, the passion to equate every fulfillment of each mitzvah with being close to God. Every page of the Gemara, every page of the Chumash, every page of Torah learning brings us closer to God. The tefillah experience, the prayer experience in the Beit HaKnesset brings us closer to God. I was very drawn by that. I was also drawn by the Lubavitch Rebbe, Zechet Tzadik Levracha, may the memory of a tzadik be for a blessing. I was very, very inspired by his radicalness, by his going out into uncharted territory in bringing what he believed to be more unity to the Jewish world and to the world at large, which he believed would usher in some type of messianic consciousness, however one understands that. And many of his decisions, many of his campaigns, many of his teachings were not always widely accepted by the status quo normative Haredi or Hasidic world. Yet he felt and shared with his Hasidim in the world at large, he felt compelled. And that very much attracted me. His feeling compelled, feeling called to, even if it means going against the grain. You don't do a dafka to go against the grain, but if it means going against the grain to bring unity, to bring, again, a sense of redemption, whatever that may mean to the individual or in a national or even global way, do it. And I just was very attracted by how the Chassidut, the teachings of Chabad, pictured the understanding of our relationship with God. However, and this is, I can only share my experience. This is, and I really want to emphasize, this is my experience. It stayed in the cerebral realm. I wanted to feel close to God. I didn't want to just understand about God. I loved learning because I'm a scholar and I love learning. I love the academics of it, the really pulling it apart, pulling the text apart, and really negotiating it and figuring out the different mafreshim and what questions they were answering, what answers meant for me or not for me. However, the Chassidut that I learned, and it could have been my time and place in the 1970s into the 1980s, it remained above my neck. I wanted to feel closeness. I needed to feel close to God. I really did. And I didn't feel the Chassidut brought me to that. And little by little, I started learning Jewish meditation. My first meditation teacher, Rav James Jacobson Meisels, who I'm indebted to, Ad Me'ev Ve'Esrim, we should all live to be 120 in the most healthy ways. He really created a shift for me. And he was very baki. He still is in the P.S. Etzner. He was my first teacher of the P.S. Etzner, actually in Pardes. Long before I taught there, teaching the P.S. Etzner, I was learning from Rav James the P.S. Etzner. And I started to actually feel God's presence. And it meant a lot to me. Although I wasn't looking for it, it meant a lot that the P.S. Etzner held a lot by the Bala Tanya. It was, for me, I felt I was entering a more evolved space inside of my own mind, body, and soul that started with Chabad, and the P.S.S. was expanding for me. Rather than in contradiction, it was a l'shachlel. He enhanced it. L'hitrachev, like Rav Kook says, l'hitrachev, to expand it, to enhance l'shachlel oto. So it was very, for me, very organic. I never felt, I'm rejecting Chabad Chassidut, and now I'm accepting the P.S.S. and the Chassidut. No, I'm taking my Chabad, my learning of Chabad Chassidut, and expanding on it through the writings of the P.S.S. and to a degree, Rav Kook, even to a degree, Netivot Shalom. And now as I'm beginning to learn the very, very, very beginning tipot, the very drops of the beginning of Rav Shagar, I feel it's really just expanding and expanding as we are moving from one decade to the next decade to the next decade.
Thank you for downloading this podcast from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. If you are interested in more digital downloads or other Jewish content, please visit elmod.pardes.org.